TexasObserver.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. In the studio this week, we have Observer staff writer Emily Duprang joining us from an undisclosed sunny location. Emily, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Later in the show, we'll catch up with Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies to find out how Julian Castro's San Antonio streetcar project became a political train wreck. But before we get to that story, there is some serious news to discuss out of Houston about police shootings. Obviously, the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, has the nation wondering about the lawful use of deadly force. Emily's latest piece wonders if an unlawful shooting could happen in your hometown. Well, if you live in Houston, the answer is, you know what, why don't you tell them, Emily?
Well, if you live in Houston, the answer, according to all the people who are in charge of determining whether a police shooting is lawful, the answer is no. You kind of can't have an unlawful shooting by a police officer in Houston. I'm saying that because I was part of the stories that I did last year. I did an 8 or 9 month investigation of use of force in Houston, and I found that from 2007 to 2012, according to HPD records, police officers shot and killed a citizen about once every 3 weeks. And not one of those has been found unjustified. In fact, none of the 550 shootings, either where somebody was killed or injured or where an animal was killed or injured, none of those were found unjustified, which is remarkable.
It's incredibly remarkable, and just for the benefit of the people listening, let's go through these stats one by one and really talk about the numbers here.
Mm-hmm. Well, so according to HPD records, officers killed citizens in 109 shootings over that time period, 2007 to 2012.
Right, 6 years.
And every killing was considered justified, and that includes some that got a huge amount of attention, such as a gentleman who was schizophrenic, and he had only one arm and one leg, and he was in a wheelchair, and he was in his group home, and he was holding a ballpoint pen, and he menaced an officer with a ballpoint pen, and the officer's partner shot and killed him. And that, at the time that I was doing the story, Internal Affairs was still doing their investigation, even though it was past the six-month limit. They said they were still doing the investigation, and they did ultimately decide that even that shooting was justified.
Let's talk about that particular case for a moment. I mean, how do you determine that a case like that is justified? What are the steps that are taken? What's the process like?
Well, it's a 6 month. Okay, there's a 6 month Internal Affairs investigation, and there's Internal Affairs investigates homicide every time that police officer in Houston fires their weapon. Homicide, Internal Affairs, and the DA's office investigate. But it's a closed process. Something that my reporting found was that basically if the police department, not even basically, but it is a fact that if the police department decides that something was not wrong, either a shooting was justified or, you know, a complaint of excessive force wasn't legitimate or whatever, if they decide, no, the person didn't do anything wrong, then the records of that investigation are sealed. So nobody has access to those. And so what the blog post that I put up today was about is the fact that, you know, 109 persons were shot and killed. 112 times, an officer shot and injured a person. and all of those were justified. There were, in that time period, there were 104 times that an officer wounded an animal and 225 times that an officer killed an animal, and all of those were considered justified. In fact, there were only 16 cases where the discharge of a gun was considered not justified, but they were all ruled accidental.
So 16 accidental shootings.
Yes, that did not have a... they didn't have a victim. So the gun went off. There were 16 times in which a gun went off, and it was considered accidental and not justified, which I guess means you weren't even... why did you even have your gun out or something like that? But because it's hard to say why how an accidental shooting would be justified, but apparently most of the time it is. And these 16 shootings that were not justified were all ruled accidental. And in more than 1 in 5 cases in which an officer fired on a citizen, and that doesn't mean 1 in 5 cases in which a citizen was injured, but 1 in 5 times that an officer fired on a citizen, the citizen was unarmed.
Right.
In that time period.
As you sort of alluded to with your story that you mentioned earlier, but you've reported on a few of these cases in detail in the past, and I'm wondering if you can tell us what you've learned about how HPD operates from those stories.
Well, what I've learned is that that the way that HPD operate, you can't take like the actions of. I mean, this is 550 shootings. Obviously, it's many individuals, but that's over 6 years, and there are 5,400 Houston police officers. So I can't tell you what officers are like from that, because obviously, I mean, that's a really small sample. But as far as how the department handles shootings, it is a closed book. It is, as you can see, there doesn't seem to be a circumstance in which an officer can do harm to a citizen, can shoot a citizen wrongly, according to HPD. So Internal Affairs investigates, homicide investigates, and then the grand jury system supports this, because there have been more than 288 times that in a row that a shooting by a Houston officer has gone to a grand jury, and the grand jury has decided in favor of the officer. 288 times in a row. So really what you see here is a system that's set up to say, well, if an officer shot and hurt or killed somebody, it had to have been justified. I mean, nobody is coming out and saying that out loud. Obviously, they would never say our police officers can do no wrong, but that's the effect, and the effect is more important than the statement.
Is there any public criticism for HPD for being so closed on cases like this?
Well, yes, but they are so closed and they're so powerful. The mayor does not, like, just totally refuses to comment either for my investigations or the Houston Chronicle did a series of investigations on shootings after my stories came out. And the mayor's office will not comment, and the mayor is very, very strong. The police union is very, very strong. And it just takes, I mean, it's their job to take the officer's side in all cases, but they do it very powerfully. And so it's hard to write about stories where, it's hard to write a story that says, they won't give us information. It's hard to make that into a news story. And so there's not as much attention to the fact, and that's something my story's trying to do, was to illustrate the fact that there is this deliberate shutdown black box where we're told by the police didn't do anything wrong, but we as a community cannot verify that.
Your story does mention sort of a separate checks and or a separate form of checks and balances here, and that is the Independent Police Oversight Board. Exactly what power do they have?
They have the power to read.
Well, that's certainly an important power.
Isn't it just?
It is.
They are a group. It's four, and the Independent Police Oversight Board has just the most ambitious name. I'm just going to start calling myself Supreme Overlord, Best Writer Ever, Emily Prang, just
I
because
don't know why you haven't started already.
I don't know why I haven't. But It is independent, except that it meets in the Houston Police Department headquarters. It is the oversight board. It is there are four groups of citizens, and they divvy up and look at all the internal affairs investigations. So they look at all the files. So once internal affairs finishes an investigation, that becomes something that this group can look at. There's four different groups of citizens divvy up the work, so it's not like one group of citizens is able to see, they only ever see a quarter of the files. So it would be difficult for them to spot patterns or recognize problem officers or this kind of thing. So that's a problem, but a much bigger problem is the fact that they have no power. They are able to look at the investigations, and if they decide, boy, this investigation, really, they should have tried to find that witness, or they, you know, this is shabby, or I don't agree with their evaluation. I think that maybe there was more to this. Then they can tell internal affairs how they feel, and internal affairs is required to write them a letter giving them a response, and the response can be no. The response can be too bad, because they're not internal affairs isn't obligated to do anything. The group cannot, they don't have subpoena power. They can't do their own investigations. They can't interview witnesses. They can only look at what the Houston Police Department wrote down and decided. And if they don't like it, they can say something, and that's it. Whenever I was writing about this, I said, you know, well, okay, what if they had a really big problem, you know, who could they appeal to? What beyond, you know, they said, well, they can talk to the Office of the Inspector General. But in Houston, the city charter specifically says that the Office of the Inspector General can investigate the mayor's office, but cannot investigate the Houston Police Department. So the Office of the Inspector General, the most that person could do is also go make a suggestion to the chief, gee, people are upset about this. But there is actually no power. And so the thing that people have been saying for years that Houston needs to actually ensure accountability is to get rid of the fake toothless boards and to have a citizen oversight board that has subpoena power, that can do investigations, that can bring charges. And then the other reform that people are suggesting is the to reform the grand jury system, where it's not that things like this case that recently came to light of this the foreman on a case of a grand jury that was looking into a cop's shooting and death, that the foreman on that grand jury was himself a current Houston police officer who knew the deceased, and right. That's just the kind of link. And then that grand jury foreman also had served on nine other grand juries at least in the past, and had and bullied and threatened this witness when she testified that her when she basically provided her boyfriend's alibi, and they were trying to get charges filed against this boyfriend for shooting a cop, and she was like, "No, he was with me," and they, you know, this foreman is, you know, turning to this someone else and saying like, "Hey, what's the penalty for perjury?" You know, and like, he bullied and threatened this witness into changing her story, and then when she did, they charged her with perjury, and she spent 4 months in jail. And this is somebody that's on a grand jury that's deciding this cop. I mean, this is something that if a grand jury system were run like the trial system, that person would never make it on, and we would all be grateful.
Well, real quick before we go, how likely is it that any of these reforms are going to go through?
I don't know. What kind of person are you? Like, it kind of depends. Some of it depends on the mayor. Our mayor is in her last allowable term. She is very strong mayor, but she is really not ever crossing the police. And it's possible that we could have new mayor and mayoral candidates, or maybe just the mayoral race have candidates that want to bring up real reform of the police department. I don't want to say it's not going to happen, but it's going to take there's been a lot more pressure on the Houston Police Department. The Chronicle's been doing some great reporting, and then the Observer certainly did their part. And I think pressure is growing, but it's very hard to see whether or not we're going to get to that point where it becomes a mainstream issue that people talk about besides just, you know, a few representatives of the groups that are most affected, which is, of course, the minority and poor community.
Well, Emily, thank you so much for being with us and for reporting on this story.
Thank you very much for having me, Jonathan.
You can read more about police shootings in Houston on TexasObserver.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Well, the same day, former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro was sworn in as the new Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, one of his signature programs in San Antonio, the so-called Modern Streetcar Project, was going off the rails. Here to help us find out what killed the streetcar and how its death has changed politics in San Antonio is Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies. Mr. Davies, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here, Jonathan. Thanks for inviting me.
If you wouldn't mind, let's take just a quick step back and talk about the modern streetcar that might have been for San Antonio.
Well, the plan that they had laid out was a pretty modest plan. It wasn't a gargantuan cross the city type of a streetcar, light rail type of effort. It really was just to circle downtown and go down Broadway to the Pearl, which is a sort of a hipster development that's doing really well just north of downtown, and try to alleviate downtown traffic from so many buses. It was a way to start bringing commuter rail to San Antonio because it was just a $280 million project with only $32 million being provided by the city. They thought that since it had such a relatively low cost that they were able to sidestep having to actually do a full election in the city, and that turned out to be actually the project's downfall. And now it is no longer happening, and the city has hit the pause button, as the new mayor, Ivy Taylor, has said, on rail, on streetcar, and they're looking to see what's the way forward.
So what exactly happened, if you don't mind?
Well, the Tea Party happened. That's what happened. It's actually just a group of four guys led by one named George Rodriguez. And they turned up at all of the VIA meetings. VIA is the local metropolitan agency. And they would wave signs, and they would protest, and they would file a Freedom of Information request and try to just gum up the works on this. And they really weren't getting very far. They were exciting the local Tea Party people. And they're conservatives who just don't like rail. They think that it is not efficient. They don't like the public transportation aspect of it. And they just think that this is not a way to move people around effectively.
Is there any research that they cite to back that up?
Yeah, they do. They have their own research. They point to the Cato Institute has been opposed to rail for a long time. And they don't like the fact that these projects are not self-supporting. Like, well, this continues to lose money. And it says, well, it's a public transportation project. You say, well, how much money did the, you know, I-35 make this year? Well, that's a public transportation project also, but they don't see it that way. So they were constantly trying to be the fly in the ointment, but since they were being overstepped and ignored by the machinery of the city and the county and VIA, and things were just going to move along over their objections. It really wasn't until another activist in San Antonio, a guy named Greg Brockhaus, started a petition drive and was able to collect significant enough signatures to put a scare into city council. And that's when they pulled the plug on streetcar.
So a few alternatives were suggested by the opposition to the streetcar project. One of them was just buses, that buses could be an adequate solution. I was wondering if you can speak to that.
Well, you know, they talk about buses in a way that it moves people the same way a train would, a tram would. There's no rail. They're more adaptable. But there's something about having rail that attracts ridership. People see the rail, they know where it's going, and they don't feel so, so off the rails. But, you know, really the story is really not so much about a transportation plan. It was really about the effort to fight City Hall on this and win. And now there are concerns that this coalition that was able to beat the light rail, that they're going to be able to stymie other progressive efforts in San Antonio that may not, and it's pitting like the north side, the affluent side of San Antonio against other parts of the city. And the north side is saying, well, we don't care about this particular project. Why should we support it? And this formation of a very hyper localism to the detriment of the city as a whole.
Your piece ends with Greg Brockhaus hoping to, as you say, usher in an era of reduced spending and the end of major downtown legacy projects. I was wondering if you could tell us what specific projects he's referring to, other than the streetcar, of course, and what sort of impact those projects have had on San Antonio.
Well, a major one is Free K for SA, which is in a pre-education program, preschool program for kids. This was definitely a Mayor Julian Castro initiative, in which they did pass a quarter cent sales tax, eighth of a cent sales tax, that would fund this program and would provide high quality free pre-K for children in San Antonio, and to raise the education attainment in the city. And they're going to look at third grade reading results as they work their way through schools as the metric to see whether or not this actually works or not. But this was criticized from the same quarter, the same anti-tax and spend type people saying that, look, we're already paying for education. We already have school districts. Why do we want the city to get involved in education also, and accusing Mayor Castro of, you just want to create schools so that you can name them after yourself and your family and whatnot. And it did go to the voters, and it was surprisingly a tough fight for Castro, but he did win eventually, but it was a squeaker. And so that and other issues like the redevelopment of Hemisphere Park, that is something that's been a lot of money is now being sunk into. Hemisphere Park is where the old 1968 World's Fair took place. It kind of not really done much with that that campus since then, but now they're trying to really revitalize it, and that seems to be the next big project to try to breathe some more life into downtown San Antonio. So those are a couple of them. There's also the redevelopment of San Pedro Creek, which something is also now just getting underway.
With Julian Castro out of the picture in San Antonio, there seems to be a bit of a political void here. I'm wondering if you can speak to us about what sort of impact this is going to have for San Antonio politics in the near future and perhaps even into the extended future.
Sure, yeah, with Castro suddenly taking the job as HUD secretary, which had been dangling in front of him for a long time, and he had turned it down and turned it down. Finally, he took the position, and you can read into that his political ambitions as you will, but many people say this was to try to season him in case there was a VP opportunity for him with the next presidential nomination. So what this created was this backfill situation in San Antonio politics. As Castro moved up, who was going to be mayor? There was a scramble for that. The city council members voted among themselves and selected Ivy Taylor and she became the first African-American female to lead a major city in the United States. And she has a background in urban planning and is a very thoughtful individual. But she was definitely not ready to stand up to the forces that had come together to fight streetcar. And so, but who's going to take her position? And now there's open. She says she's not going to run for mayor in May. That we have now Representative Mike Villarreal, state rep, who is saying he's definitely running. He has announced that he is running. We're seeing people now jockeying to see who's going to replace him. And now there's also talk that state Senator Leticia Vandeput, after this November election, you know, it is a tough road to hoe to beat the Republican Party in a general election in Texas. Hasn't
right.
happened in 20 years.
Right.
So they say that she may not be ready to go back to the state Senate and deal with a Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. And even though she denies that she will run for governor, there are forces in San Antonio that are sort of preparing a campaign for her post-November in case that she does want to make that decision. So so who would replace State Senator Vandeput? You know, it goes on and on pretty much. But Castro, it wasn't just him leaving and creating a void. You know, he was held a coalition in San Antonio of progressives along with moderates and along with the San Antonio business community. And so if that does not hold and there's a new coalition that forms along Tea Party lines and conservatives, and then they're able to grab the business community, then there's a big question about what direction San Antonio is going to go in. And we do have the November election, and San Antonio, hopefully, you know, San Antonio, you know, Battleground Texas wants to turn the state blue, but, you know, there are forces that want to turn San Antonio, Bexar County, red.
Right.
And we'll see if that happens.
Well, you can read David Martin Davies' story, A Desire Named Streetcar, on TexasObserver.org. Mr. Davies, I greatly appreciate you being with us today.
Hey, Jonathan, thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
And that about wraps it up for Observer Radio this week. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at TexasObserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.